Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin by going to Tahrir Square in Egypt and get an update on the second Egyptian revolution. First from Rabab El Mahdi, who's a professor of political science at the American University in Cairo, and then from Joshua Hirsch, who covers U.S. foreign policy and the State Department for the Huffington Post. He is in Cairo covering the upcoming Egyptian elections. Then we'll hear from a veteran financial reporter and Wall Street insider, William Cohen, the author of a new book, Money and Power, How Goldman Sachs Came to Rule the World. We will discuss how corporate America is sitting on piles of cash that, rather than investing it in plant and equipment or on R&D, the top executives are using their idle billions to buy back company stock in order to reward themselves at the expense of the workers they are laying off. Then finally, on Thanksgiving, in the spirit of being thankful for positive social trends that offer hope in a time of economic distress, political polarization, deadlock, and dysfunction, Stephen Schwartz, a senior fellow at the Samueli Institute, joins us to discuss how some communities are tackling hunger and homelessness in a humane and healing manner, separate and apart from the government programs or church-related charities. Joining us now is Rabab El Mahdi, who's a professor of political science at the American University in Cairo. A field of specialization is comparative political economy and development with a focus on Latin America and the Middle East. El Mahdi's research interests cover the areas of state-civil society relations, social movements and resistance, as well as political economy and social policy. Before joining American University Cairo, she worked for several development organizations, including NGOs and UN agencies. Welcome to Background Briefing, Rabab El Mahdi. Rabab, you're in Tahrir Square as we speak, right?
Yes, I am.
And tell me about the latest concessions, if you will, from the military, the ruling military junta. Does anybody believe that they are sincere in wanting to transfer power to the revolution?
Absolutely not. So, I mean, if you look at the numbers on the square today, they're actually as high as they were. And again, we're calling for another protest on Friday, a million, a certain march, just like we had yesterday when the square was completely full.
So do many people regret not staying with the revolution and, in a sense, handing the revolution over to the generals?
No, I think we've learned you have two sets of people. One is the group of those people who weren't with the revolution even back in January, who wanted Mubarak to continue, just like anywhere in the world, when you have a society divided in terms of change. Now what you're having is that millions see that it was a mistake to leave Tahrir Square and hand it to SCAF, but you will also have other Egyptians who are very skeptical of what's going on.
So what pressure is being put on the generals apart from the people? Do you think that the United States, given that a considerable amount of military aid is given to the Egyptian military every year, do you think that they could put some pressure on, or is there any evidence that they are?
Put pressure on what, Ian? The United States government could at least have stopped exporting the tear gas that they're using. I have a number of cancers with Made in USA. That's actually part of the American aid to Egypt. We don't want them to pressure SCAF. We just want them to stop giving them the tear gas and the ammunition that they shoot at us with. And look at the statements that the American administration, has been watching the killing just exactly like back in January, and then issued a statement saying that they think the field marshal's speech yesterday addresses the issue. Just like how they supported Mubarak until the last day. The U.S. administration is self-serving, pragmatic, hypocritical. It only sides with us on the square once they see that the dictatorship is falling. But any time before that, they don't put any pressure. For them, the most important thing is to have the quote-unquote stability.
The elections that are planned, that are coming up, are they going to go ahead as scheduled? Not to mention, of course, the presidential elections.
Yes, they said they're going to go ahead with the parliamentary elections. There is no need to cancel the elections. Both things can go hand in hand, the sitting and the elections. Both are political tools that we're going to use to reach the transfer of power to civilian rule.
And in terms of those that are demonstrating in the square now, the press over here is suggesting it's largely the Muslim Brotherhood. From where you're standing in Tahrir Square,
well,
I said, the way that the press is reporting what is happening in Tahrir Square is that it's largely the Muslim Brotherhood that are protesting. From where you stand, what is the complexion of the crowd?
The Muslim Brotherhood are not protesting. The Muslim Brotherhood are not on the square as an organization. I don't know where your press is getting those reports. They issued a clear statement saying that they will not be on the square. This whole Islamophobia, the Western media have any time we're on the square, it's the Islamists, it's mere imagination. I have fought with the Muslim Brotherhood leadership, actually, to get them to support this sitting, and they refused, and it's a clear statement against the sitting. It's an insult to assume that all Egyptians cannot be mobilized until the Muslim Brotherhood says so.
So in terms of the U.S., the U.S. has very little credibility with you and your colleagues there, but the way the press is reporting these demonstrations against the military and their intransigence is largely they're suggesting that it's all the Muslim Brotherhood. You're there in Tahrir Square. What's the political makeup of those that are protesting?
Are you finding, just again like last January, the majority of those who are on the square and do not belong to any organized political faction. But yet again, you have part of the Muslim Brotherhood members who defied their organization and are currently on the square. You have Muslim Salafis who are actually camping on the square. You have leftists, you have the youth organizations.
And we just lost the call with Rabab El Mahdi in Tahrir Square. Joining us now is Joshua Hirsch, who covers U.S. foreign policy and the State Department for The Huffington Post. From December 2010 to July 2011, he was one of the original staff reporters for The Daily, News Corporation's newspaper for the iPad, where he covered the revolution in Egypt, politics in Washington, D.C., and general domestic and international affairs. As a freelance writer and journalist, his work has appeared in The New Yorker, The National in Abu Dhabi, The Atlantic Monthly Online, and The New Republic and other places. He's currently in Cairo covering the Egyptian elections and protests in Tahrir Square for The Huffington Post. Welcome to Background Briefing, Joshua Hirsch.
Yes, hello. Thanks for having me.
And just speaking with our earlier guest, I brought up the question of the complexion of those demonstrating. Largely, the reporting that I've been reading suggests that it's dominated by the Muslim Brotherhood, and she was actually quite offended by that and said, no, you know, I'm trying to drag them out here, you know. So what's your reading on the complexion of those?
No, she's exactly right. Actually, it's very complicated. I won't take offense because I'm sort of above it quite literally, and just it's not my fight. I'm just here as an observer. But it's very complicated, and I do understand how hard it can be from thousands of miles away to keep track of these micro maneuverings. Now in the pseudo new Egypt, there are politics at play in addition to power dynamics. The Muslim Brotherhood has not participated in this protest at all, more or less. Their younger, more radical members have, but they actually have not. So she's right. This dynamic right now, rather than being a left and right, if you will, kind of thing, is about people who believe that the regime that has been put in place after Mubarak represents some kind of transition, that it's done something, that it is holding the key to future democracy, and that we should just let the process play out, establishment sort of folks, if you will, versus those who believe very strongly that the revolution is not finished and they need to take back to the streets to rekindle it. And the Muslim Brotherhood, as it happened, falls in the establishment category on this one.
Well, haven't they made a fairly advantageous deal with the generals in terms of the upcoming elections that you're there to cover?
I think deal isn't quite right. Deal. There's always been a lot of insinuation here about that. The reality is they're very popular, so they're in a very good position to do well in the elections. That's almost definitely the case. That's a fact of demographics, more or less. And maybe I think the other thing that people do say that's close to conspiracy but not quite is that because they've been around so long and are so well organized, they are more likely to have their message out and have their party structure built up. So an election taking place now is going to be disproportionately beneficial to the more organized parties.
So what is happening in terms of shaming the generals? Clearly, they have held on to power. They've been intransigent, but they've also been incompetent, I think. The idea of them preparing for elections, that's not their expertise. Since you've covered the State Department, Joshua Hirsch, who's weighing in on our side? Because we have some leverage over the Egyptian military since we give them a couple of billion a year.
Yeah, that's true. We do, and I think that leverage played into their hands, and it seemed for a time into everyone's favor back in February when we were able to kind of lean over and whisper to our buddies in the Egyptian military, "Hey, maybe get rid of this guy, this Mubarak guy, and let's move things along here." The question was how far we were willing to push and how far they were willing to go organically. To see it through to the kind of democratic, truly democratic vision and civilian-run state that the demonstrators in Tahrir Square at the time thought they were getting. It turned out not very far, and that's tested American policy, like you say. The State Department is very adamant that they favor moving towards democracy, democratic elections in abstract. I think that they're very worried about the Muslim Brotherhood winning elections, what that means, and the rise of not just the Brotherhood, but other smaller but quite potent religious minorities like the Salafis, the Salafists, who are a pretty powerful organized group here, much more conservative Muslims. The other sort of key piece is the Department of Defense, who has their own relationship with the military, a very close one, and doesn't really have to listen to what Hillary Clinton's operation tells them to do in terms of policy.
So our previous guest was actually quite angry at, she said she's collected several tear gas canisters with "Made in the USA" stamped on them, and didn't feel that the U.S. When I asked that similar question about what leverage would you want to be applied, basically I got this tirade of anger. Mm. So we're not winning hearts and minds there. Who is there in charge? Because I think my impression is that both state and DOD are preoccupied in Iraq and Afghanistan and distracted by Libya and Syria. I'm not sure whether we have any point people on Egypt.
I'm not entirely sure either. We have a very brand new at the State Department, a brand new ambassador for these emerging democracies or transitioning democracies. He was just appointed very recently, named William Taylor. He's been out here a couple of times, but that's not a powerful figure in terms of moving the machinery of American politics, or for that matter, the Egyptian regime. I think it's much more opaque who is in charge and how exactly that works. So these relationships are built because top military officials in the Egyptian military come to train with the American generals many times a year, and this relationship is 30, 40 years old, and that's an independent relationship that doesn't really have to be accounted for in the U.S.
So, in terms of the emotions there in Tahrir Square, the impression I get is that a lot of the people who brought about the Arab Spring Revolution feel like maybe they dropped the ball. They should have stayed there, and there was euphoria at the time that the army are our brothers, and et cetera. And clearly, people are rethinking that they essentially handed the revolution on a platter to the military. But going back to the original revolution and this current revolution, the impression you get is that the so-called liberals, the young, the techno-savvy, the modern, perhaps Western-oriented types, are the ones that propel both revolutions. They're out there in the squares doing the heavy lifting. But at the end of the day, they're not going to benefit from it as much as the Brotherhood, who sat on the sidelines.
I think there's a lot of truth to that. I think that some Brotherhood figures have come to the square and been chased out by the people here. It's not just the young sort of technocratic liberal sort of savvy guys. I think arguably the people who are this particular revolution, this version of it versus February is a little more volatile, a lot more volatile. There's sustained violence. I'm sure you've heard about this, tear gas and all that stuff. That's all taking place about a block from Tahrir Square, attached to it, but not in the square proper. And those kids who were running around those alleys fighting with the police there in a pretty vicious and now four-day-old standoff, most of them are poor, apolitical kids from the suburbs of Cairo who have nothing and just have experienced nothing but police brutality. And it's a little bit of a more emotional down with the police kind of mentality or down with the brutal state mentality. But those two interests have come together. And it's just what's not entirely clear is whether they are matched by similar political interests across the country. They seem to be in February. The Muslim Brotherhood is clearly calculating that they are not right now. It's hard to gauge, to be honest. From within Tahrir, where it seems like everyone agrees on something.
And are the Copts in any way present, given that there have been sectarian violence meted out against the Copts? I spoke about that recently with a couple of Wall Street Journal reporter and others who said that the Copts were feeling quite abandoned. Is there a presence there, or are they just sort of laying low?
I think there is. It's not an obvious one, but I do think that they're part of the sort of the mix in terms of liberals or working class folk. A lot of the Copts are working class, so they're mixed in with that kind of group. I think you'd probably identify them more as the work of the laborers and the fighters than by their religion here. The Copts were a big issue under the military regime. They've almost never come up in the last week, as far as I can tell. Mm-hmm. Right now, this is about kind of the revolutionaries trying to reclaim what they say is an unfinished revolution more than anything else. And the Copts are one example of the ways in which they say the military regime just carried on with the abuses of the previous regime.
Well, just in closing, Joshua Hirsch, the military proposed, of course, the elections not happening for another couple of years. They wanted to exempt themselves from any civilian oversight. What kind of real compromise has been made? I take it at least the presidential elections have been moved forward till July of next year. What's your sense of the parliamentary elections? How are they going to pan out?
Well, they're at this point going to happen. We all sort of stood around yesterday, 2 days ago, saying, "How the heck could that be the case?" But every day it gets closer. It might just happen. I mean, in one sense, they're spread out over. They're scheduled to be spread out over about a month and a half. If it goes badly in Cairo, which is the Cairo version, it takes place on Monday. It's okay because they can just continue on in the rest of the country. I mean, that's one sort of cynical way of looking at it. But they have a presidential election, I think, is the one that the protesters are very concerned about. That has been moved back steadily by the military, almost vaguely pushed back until about 2013. So they promised last night that they would move it up to June of next year, which is still, I believe, I'm pretty sure, after the initial date they had. So it didn't do anything to sate the people here. What sort of compromise will, it's not entirely clear.
Well, Joshua Hirsch, I thank you so much for joining us, and I hope we can stay in touch and do a follow-up.
Yeah, I'd love to. Thank you so much.
Again, I've been speaking with Joshua Hirsch, who covers U.S. foreign policy and the State Department for the Huffington Post, and he is currently in Cairo covering the Egyptian elections and the protest in Tahrir Square. And we're going to take a brief station break now and we'll be back talking about how corporate America is sitting on piles of cash, which they're using to buy back stock rather than invest in R&D and keep their workers busy.
الجماهير صوتك في ميدان التحرير أمل الثورة والتغيير